This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The video of five plain-clothed officers as they brutally arrested Yusuf Kawoya sparked outrage in Uganda.
That's Halima Atumani reporting from Kampala. Details coming up also. The Ethiopian government yesterday signed a peace deal with a previously outlawed organization. The European Union today allocated $8.3 million to groups fighting the Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC. And President Paul Biya has been declared the winner of Cameroon's October 7th presidential election. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Uganda's security forces are under scrutiny after a video was made public last week showing plain-clothed officers brutally beating and arresting a civilian on the street. Uganda's army spokesman says the troops are facing a disciplinary committee, but the family of the victim say they are not being told what happened to their relative. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
The video of five plain-clothed officers as they brutally arrested Yusuf Kawoya sparked outrage in Uganda. Each armed with an AK-47 rifle, the men in broad daylight grab Kawoya in the street. As he falls on the road, the unknown security men pounce. One man uses the butt of his rifle to repeatedly hit Kawoya in the lower abdomen before he is taken away. Kawoya's sister, Sharifa Nachitende, says since the assault last Thursday, her family has not been able to get authorities to tell them why her elder brother was arrested or where he is being held.
The trauma that is in the children, the fear, and our mother, all the family members, they're in shock.
The biggest fear is my brother may not be alive. He was badly tortured.
After the video of the beating and arrest was made public, the Ugandan army and police forces initially denied any knowledge of the five security men. But on Friday evening, army spokesman Brigadier Richard Karamire released photos of the men appearing before a disciplinary committee. Without identifying the men or their unit, the five were charged with conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. The army says they pleaded guilty to the charges, which carry maximum punishment of disgraceful discharge. Army and police spokespeople have refused to comment further on the matter, saying it is before the court. But the brutal arrest left many Ugandans like Anthony Mukalazi in shock.
The manner in which a fellow Ugandan can be arrested, we had gotten used to sticks. Now if you come and you arrest and you're thumbing people with guns, it shows the level of impunity that the country has. So it was really heartbreaking. And as Ugandans, you cannot be sure that you'll be safe the next time someone comes to arrest you.
Kawoya, a businessman, is a member of the opposition People Power Group, created by musician turned opposition politician Robert Chagurani, better known as Bobby Wine. Wine was himself arrested in August, allegedly tortured and charged with treason, along with other opposition lawmakers. Authorities accused them of throwing stones at President Yoweri Museveni's car. Human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio says Ugandans are living in what is nearly a rogue state.
You're only alive because nobody wants to kill you. Every single day, there are countless stories of innocent civilians who have disappeared in the hands of gun-wielding, non-uniformed individuals. I think for me, it's the shadow state. It is a very dangerous practice whose sole intention is to instill fear, whose sole intention is to target regime opponents.
Opio says the rest of the world needs to know that the pretense about Uganda being democratic and civil is no longer believable. He says foreign powers that supply weapons to Uganda need to question whether their support is being used to violate human rights. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Taking another step towards reducing ethnic tensions, the Ethiopian government yesterday signed a peace deal with the Ogaden National Liberation Front, ONLF. It had previously outlawed the organization as a terrorist group. The ONLF began fighting for secession for the Somali region, also known as Ogaden in eastern Ethiopia, in 1984. Earlier this year, the Ethiopian parliament removed it from a list of banned movements as part of reforms led by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has extended an olive branch to opponents since taking office earlier this year. The ONLF declared a ceasefire in August. The two sides will form a joint committee to discuss the roots of the conflict in the region, which is rich in oil and gas. Another sign of reform, an Ethiopian marathon runner who made global headlines with an anti-government gesture at the 2016 Olympics has returned from exile. Family and fans greeted Olympic silver medalist Fayisa Lelessa at the airport, along with Foreign Minister Workin Gabayo. The runner held his arms over his head, wrists crossed, as he finished second in the Olympics in solidarity with protesters in his home region, Oromoya. Afterwards, he felt threatened by the previous government and sought asylum in the United States. When it came into force in 1987, the treaty known as the United Nations Convention Against Torture represented a milestone for human rights activists. Since 2006, 87 countries have signed on to the Convention on the Prevention of Torture. It's overseen by a 25-member committee dedicated to ensuring that detainees in member states are not tortured or subjected to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. To find out more about the committee's work, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with its chairman, Sir Malcolm Evans.
We live in a complex world where state actors are often tempted to resort to violence to quash dissent, and where detainees also often suffer from neglect, mismanagement, and lack of funds. But Sir Malcolm Evans says that the idea behind his committee's work with member states is relatively simple to understand.
We've got the right to visit any place of detention that we choose to go to interview and speak to detainees, see what conditions of detention are like, how they're treated.
Under the terms of the convention, those reports remain confidential unless a country permits their release to the public. This offers a face-saving way to put things right. But without the risk of public embarrassment, couldn't governments punish detainees who allege torture and abuse? Evans says no.
We take the question of sanctions and reprisals against those people who speak to us hugely seriously. The legal instruments, the conventions, provide clear obligations that no one should suffer any sanction or reprisal for speaking with us, and that is something we insist upon.
It is impractical for the UN to investigate each detention facility in all 87 signatory countries on an ongoing basis. That's why, crucially, all parties to the convention are obliged to set up their own domestic investigating committees within 1 year.
So on a day-to-day basis, there are independent monitors, inspectors going into prisons, police stations, psychiatric hospitals, immigration detention centres in many, many countries around the world and many, many countries in Africa, speaking to hundreds, if not thousands, of detainees, getting a real picture of what is going on and being able to make a very real difference to those responsible for the running of the place.
Evans says that globally, 12 nations have failed to meet this obligation. Seven are in Africa. They include Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, and Liberia.
I myself will be heading a delegation returning to Liberia in a fortnight's time to see how they're progressing in relation to this following our previous visit some years ago.
Sometimes a simple innovation can help remedy a situation where detainees are at risk. For example, prisons and detention centers are often dangerously overcrowded, creating inhumane conditions. In some prisons, up to 70% of the detainees are accused of a crime but have yet to be arraigned or put on trial. In Africa, That can be due in part to a lack of reliable roads and transport, and a shortage of security guards to safely convey detainees from the facility to the courts.
So we've suggested such a simple thing. Well, why don't you take the judges or the magistrates to the prison and set up a temporary courtroom in the prison where you can process these things? If you can't take the person to the court, take the court to the person. Some have done that. And as a result, the numbers being held for prolonged periods pre-trial has fallen significantly, overcrowding has reduced, and everyone benefits from that. It's just one very simple example. We're just sometimes thinking a little bit out of the box and then try to put people on the spot to say, well, why don't you do it? There is a solution to this problem.
The Committee to Prevent Torture's 2018 report calls special attention to the plight of migrants in detention, who often lack the benefits and protections detainees native to the country enjoy. Committee Chairman Sir Malcolm Evans observes that migrants are often stereotyped by the public or viewed as mere statistics by policymakers. He says that humanizing migrant detainees by telling their personal stories of struggle and flight is now a key part of the committee's work. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
16 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. President Paul Biya has been declared the winner of Cameroon's October 7th presidential election. The 86-year-old's new term ends in 2025. Cameroon's Constitutional Council declared Biya won 71% of the vote, followed by Maurice Kamto with 14%. There were seven other candidates. Protesters in the capital Yaoundé came out singing that Biya had stolen Kamto's victory. Troops quickly dispersed them. The opposition parties had filed complaints of widespread irregularities, insecurity and low turnout, especially in the Anglophone regions where there has been separatist violence over the past few years. Last week, the Constitutional Court said there was not enough evidence to throw out the results of the vote. The European Union today allocated $8.3 million to groups fighting the Ebola outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. That brings its total aid for the outbreak to nearly $15 million. The announcement comes after rebels with the Ugandan Allied Democratic Forces attacked Beni, the epicenter of the outbreak. They killed at least 12 civilians and kidnapped 15 others. World Health Organization officials warn that the violence in the region where several rebel groups operate increases the risk the outbreak may spread. Health workers have been threatened because the disease is unfamiliar in the region. Many residents resist containment efforts such as safe burials for Ebola victims and monitoring of their contacts. There have been at least 237 confirmed or probable cases and 153 Ebola deaths in the region, which is near the border with Uganda. Nigeria, the Kaduna state government has imposed a 24-hour curfew in Kaduna town and surrounding communities because of fears of reprisal attacks following days of sectarian violence. More than 50 people have died in fighting between youths in the city and neighboring areas since Thursday. The national government has deployed special forces to the region in an attempt to restore calm. Residents say clashes broke out between Muslims and Christians in the area on Thursday, and they escalated until security forces were able to get control Sunday. The region has seen periodic violence over the past decades among different religious and ethnic communities. There are fears it could escalate ahead of the national elections in February. Obstetric fistula is both preventable and treatable, but a number of factors mean most women in Africa suffer delays in getting treatment. Reporter Gift Agirega from Abuja, Nigeria, recently visited some fistula treatment centers in northern Nigeria. She takes a look at some of the challenges patients face.
Rural northern Nigeria can be isolated and impoverished. At the Gambo Sawaba Fistula Center in Zaria, doctors say poverty is often the biggest obstacle for women who need treatment. Most women and girls who are victims of obstetric fistula live far away from the nearest hospital, and transportation could be too expensive. Dr. Adamu Husseina, the principal medical officer, says patients need to be able to pay for their food during a long hospital stay.
Many of them that cannot feed themselves. Sometimes if they come and you tell them, you are staying in the hospital, it will take you so weeks to months, depending on how the surgery goes. They will not stay because of food. So food becomes an issue. It's not the hospital that feeds them. They bring their own food items unless we have assistance.
An obstetric fistula is a tear between the vagina and the rectum or bladder, usually caused by a traumatic childbirth. The tear allows body waste to leak continually, so victims often are shunned by their families and neighbors. Nigeria accounts for nearly 40% of the world's obstetric fistula cases, which also are known as physical vaginal fistulas. That's partly because so many young women give birth far from hospitals without trained midwives. Dr. Husseina says the center has seen a drop in aid from charities whose contributions are usually time-bound. The Gambo Sawaba Fistula Center can handle about 47 patients, and that usually is not enough. It struggles with power outages and a lack of supplies. While waiting for surgery or while recovering, patients get counseling on how to cope with health issues and how to have healthy pregnancies. And the hospital has a mini vocational and rehabilitation center. The young women can learn skills like bead making, sewing, and soap making to enable them be self-reliant after they leave the hospital. The patients use rugs to protect themselves from staining wherever they sit because they cannot afford adult diapers. But the nurses at the hospital say the rugs leave the patients at risk of infections and sores. One patient, Lami Sada, says most patients cannot afford their basic needs in the hospital.
She says she is treated well here. She arrived here alone and without enough money to buy food and toiletries. That's the challenge she faces. Some people used to bring food for the patients, but they do not always come around as often as they used to.
Dr. Stephen Baturi is a fistula surgeon and consulting gynecologist at the Barau Dikko Teaching Hospital in Nigeria's Kaduna State. He says his hospital doesn't often see fistula patients.
Oh, we don't see patients a lot here is because of the charges that we charge patients when they come for surgery, because this is a tertiary center and it's not a designated review center. Most of the sufferers are paupers. They don't have the resources to pay for the surgeries.
He appealed for support from aid organizations and the government to allow the hospital to care for fistula patients. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
In Zimbabwe, the government says it is bringing the country's economic problems under control, but inflation rates are nearing levels not seen since the economic collapse of 2008. The country has been also hit by fuel shortages. Reporter Adi Gondo, who is in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, takes a look at the situation there.
Observers say the trigger of the crisis is the speculative behavior of money dealers who profit from currency fluctuations. But they say even more important is a new tax increase on electronic money transfers. It has caused a scarcity of fuel and a jump in prices of basic goods. Some shops are closing out of fear of losing the fight against the galloping inflation. Zimbabwe's financial system also contributes to the problem. The country uses currencies such as the South African rand and the US dollar alongside official bond notes. The notes can only purchase domestically produced goods. Exports are low, and therefore, so are foreign currency reserves. Zimbabwe is not able to earn enough US dollars to buy the imported goods and services that it needs. As a result, in Bulawayo, there are queues for imported fuels, including diesel, which are in short supply. For one motorist, Mr. John Dembo, the solution to the crisis is political and some might say rather drastic.
My friend, things are tough. Yeah. It's far much better to opposite party. Things are very, very tough. Yeah, we want to opposite party because things are very, very tough. All prices that have gone up. Yeah. I think 200% or 1,000%. Yeah. And also fuel, a litre you can get $2.50 a litre. From $1.35.
The government is blamed for the taxes that are in turn said to be behind the surge in prices. But authorities say the medicine, though painful, is necessary. Still, ordinary Zimbabweans like Mildred Grove, a mother of two, bear the brunt of the shortages.
If only the Minister of Finance could cancel that 2% thing, because people are now panicking and the rates for the foreign currency are just rising every 3 hours. So, hey, I don't know where I'm really going with this situation, shortage of important commodities like cooking oil, sugar, flour, short supply. It's really bad. They're increasing, I think, every day, every hour, prices are increasing. If only the government could give a hint to the Minister of Finance to cancel that 2%.
Observers say the reality of Zimbabwe's economic situation is wasteful spending. Government spent US $3.8 billion in the first 6 months of the year against revenues of US $2.5 billion, creating a deficit of US $1.3 billion. Thomas Stolle is a political scientist based in Bulawayo, and he weighs in on the subject.
In an economy like ours, where you have around 90% unemployment rate, surely, how do you tax unemployed people? Our economy at the moment is highly informalized because people are outside formal employment. So I think the tax regime that has been put in place by government is not going to work. It's going to bite the ordinary person in a very negative way because already Zimbabweans are highly taxed given the fact that they are not employed. So they're trying to make ends. So it's going to spiral. I think it's going to push citizens on the brink. We're most likely going to see food riots and most likely going to see protests again if this situation is not arrested in time.
In essence, the government is spending more than it's making. To balance the budget, officials have to raise money and cut expenditures. The new finance minister recently revealed that 70% of its revenues pay for the civil service, which he plans to cut. Economists say it makes sense to tax electronic banking, which represents US$65 billion and 90% of all financial transactions. The problem, in their view, is the government's record of inconsistency. They say it has failed to follow through on a long list of economic reforms. Some doubt the public will support the government's new policies when many Zimbabweans feel they're already paying too much in taxes and that the government is not carrying its own weight. Reporting for VOA in Bulawayo, this is Adi Gondo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
Friends, this is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show.
Our topic next week will be cocktails.
This is next Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.